Welcome to EI Talks. I'm Alistair Benn, Deputy Editor of Engelsberg Ideas, and this week I'm joined by Christopher Harding, a cultural historian of Japan and author of The Light of Asia, a history of Western fascination with the East, and a contributor to EI. We are going to be talking about Studio Ghibli, the Japanese celebrated production company, and its great director, the master Japanese animator Miyazaki Hayao. We're going to comment on his latest, maybe last film, The Boy and the Heron, which is now on general release in UK cinemas. Since Studio Ghibli was founded in 1985, its output has delighted audiences across the world, and it's delivered hit after hit, as well as being a major component of Japanese soft power and an important cultural export. The films are standalone aesthetic achievements, approaching universal themes, including environmental decay and disaster, industrialization and militarism, and doing so in a uniquely Japanese spirit, reflecting and refracting the country's turbulent modern history. Among all of Japan's many gifts to the world, Studio Ghibli is one of the most significant. Chris, what explains the company's extraordinary success?
I think one of the reasons often given, actually, and I suppose it takes us back to the period that this film is set in, which is the Second World War, is that after that war, Japanese animators, a handful of them, and I think Miyazaki is one of those, were determined that they would produce the kind of work, although it was aimed at children, it would never talk down to children. It would try to reveal to children what the adult world was really like, you know, that it was complicated. Adults aren't necessarily to be trusted. They're very fallible. And by making cartoons, which almost a sacrilege to call them cartoons, animations, let's say, which try to open up the world to children in that fairly complex way, I think that's part of the appeal for Ghibli around the world, because it's a mile away from a lot of what we're used to in the West, from those, you know, those slightly more morally straightforward sort of output that we would associate the world of animation with. It's something else entirely. And I think people just really get drawn into that, the idea that you would take the world of children seriously and try and open it up is something that, yeah, I think you would have struggled to find in much of Western animation. And so that ended up being something that Ghibli could come along and offer.
Could you give a sense of Japan's longer history and relationship to pictographic arts, you know, widely recognised, globally recognised? Where do these traditions come from?
I think it's very old in Japan. So you can find these old hand scrolls called emaki going back to the equivalent of Japan's medieval era. One of the first ones shows, I think it's called, the translation is something like fart battle, which shows a bunch of people stuffing themselves with sweet potatoes and then blowing each other away with their own flatulence. You have also kind of political satire going on, satirizing Buddhist clergy of the day. So I think it goes back many centuries, the idea of using visual art in a satirical way, you know, of course, sometimes in a very serious way as well. And then as you get into the modern era, when Japan gets its first equivalent of newspapers, you have cartoons in those, again, a mixture of political satire and more easygoing children's fare. All the way through into the Second World War, it became quite controversial because, as you see in the United States with, I suppose, cartoons like Popeye, also the Looney Tunes, it got taken up into the wartime propaganda. So some of Japan's best-loved cartoons ended up getting caught up in that. But I think its status after the war has been not just entertainment, but also, I think it's not saying too much to suggest that it's now and again the conscience of the nation. It's where people go to really think through the country's issues quite seriously. That's certainly how manga and anime is seen in Japan. Yes, they're entertainment, but they're never just frivolous.
Miyazaki himself is part of a generation, I guess, that was deeply affected by the war. I mean, his father worked on fighter planes. His fellow director, Takahata Izao, you know, witnessed bombing raids, the terrors of warfare. And these are themes that run through the films as well.
Absolutely. I think another name might throw in there would be Osamu Tezuka, sometimes talked about as the godfather of manga, so a little bit older than Miyazaki. Miyazaki was still a very small child when the war ended. I think he was born in, beginning of 1941. Osamu Tezuka was a little bit older than Miyazaki at that point, but he remembered seeing dead bodies floating down the river in Osaka after the firebombing. And he was one of those, alongside people like Miyazaki, who, as I said a moment ago, really kickstarted this idea of animation that is serious about the really mixed nature of the adult world and trying to communicate that to children. I think partly where that comes from, after the war, you have a not just animators, but I think intellectuals in general in Japan were looking at what had happened in the late 30s and the 40s and saying to themselves, how is it that a population relatively highly educated ended up being drawn into this catastrophic vision of what Japan should be as a country, and how far it should try and extend its borders? We need to have a population that is a little bit more ready to question authority and to be skeptical about what we're being told. And I think part of the job of these animators, as people like Miyazaki saw it, was to provide at least one aspect of that education to Japan's children.
Just to return, you mentioned the differences between the cartoons, Japanese traditions, and maybe American cartoons. I mean, I'm thinking of Walt Disney Studios, and I was just reflecting that the US and Japan have a kind of interesting relationship. Like, I guess they developed at similar times, became countries of world significance in the same period, and Studio Ghibli films have had a huge influence on American culture and on Walt Disney, but there is also that tetchiness as well. Actually, and also specifically, Walt Disney distributed the films, but it's not always been a happy relationship. Miyazaki's criticized Disney. I guess, could you give a sense of how Japan has looked to America for inspiration, but also how that's often happened in reverse too?
Yeah, I think Disney, as you say, was really important in Japan. So someone like Osamu Tezuka, who I mentioned a moment ago, very much influenced by Disney films. And when he started out in manga and later on producing animations. One of his most famous ones came to US television screens in the 1960s as Atom Boy. He was always a bit disappointed that he couldn't produce animation in his own day to quite the standard of Disney, because he didn't have, they weren't, there simply weren't enough animators in Japan in the 1950s and 1960s to produce with the kind of frame rate that Disney used. So he was in awe of Disney, also disappointed that he couldn't quite keep up with the same level of production. I think in terms of the tensions, one of them, a tension between someone like Osamu Tezuka and his animation studio and the United States was that when some of the Atom Boy episodes were being sent over to the US to be ready for broadcast over there, now and again they would get a message back saying, you have to cut this, you have to cut that, because it's a level of graphic violence that American children aren't accustomed to and that basically, you know, American parents won't stand for. And for someone like Osamu Tezuka, he would say, well, you know, look at what the United States did to Japan in the war, and yet now you're saying you're not terribly big fans of violence. So there's always that political tension, I think, simmering away in the background. And as legend has it, after the Disney and Ghibli deal got made that you alluded to a moment ago, there was an attempt by the American side to slightly cut back some of the material in one or two of these films. And apparently, a samurai sword was sent in the post to the American production company with a note attached saying no cuts. I'm not sure if that's true or not, but it's a wonderful story, so it's worth having out there.
I mean, I was so struck by the complexity of these films. I think I read somewhere that a 2-hour animation film from Studio Ghibli needs 170,000 images. And they all have to be hand drawn, like over each other. I mean, that is an extraordinary degree of complexity.
It really is, isn't it? And I think Miyazaki, at least until right at the end of his career, has been a real purist about that and quite a vocal critic of CGI. I think with this latest film that we'll be talking about in a moment, just the age that he is now, I think he had to delegate a lot more than he would have wanted to. I think he focused more on the storyboards. But in the past, yes, he was absolutely meticulous. And I suppose an element of this, my son, teenager, is very much into Japanese animation now, and he's a speaker of Japanese, so he follows on Twitter a few animators in Japan always complaining online of the sheer work rate that they're being required to keep up with. I think it's a terribly difficult industry to work in. Even back in the 1960s, it was said that when some of the animation slides had been finished, before they were sent off, they had to be wiped clean of blood because the animators have been working so hard, their fingers are just bleeding all over the place.
Oh
So
my God.
it's a terribly labor-intensive industry and not very well remunerated.
And Miyazaki himself, he's now 82, and he does say that he has now retired. I mean, he has retired before, but he's come back to his work. And I guess that just shows how devoted he is to the work and to that craft.
I think that's right. He's infamous, as you say, for reporting his own retirement and then reappearing. So I think the last big claim to that effect was 10 years ago, just over 10 years ago, when The Wind Rises came out. He said that that would be his final film. And then I think 3 years later, 2016, was when he first sat down and began work on this one. So who knows? Who knows really whether this is the last one? But I think certainly people who've seen this film, The Boy and the Heron, are pretty happy to see it be his last, because they say it feels like it's packed full with so many of his big concerns across his career.
Yeah, let's get into the film itself. I mean, I saw it a couple of weeks ago, and I was very, very struck by it. I was really deeply affected by it, actually. I found the climax of the film, I actually left the cinema sobbing uncontrollably. It really set me off, and I think that's because the film is so full of very powerful symbols, as you say, symbols that have been elaborated and worked out in a lot of his films. And I had the real feeling that it was a bit of a late masterpiece, this film. I mean, the lead animator, Honda Takeshi, said recently that Miyazaki had told him, I don't have much time. And I think the film is so, it's very obviously autobiographical. The father figure in the film is a tycoon in a flight plane factory, and so is Miyazaki's. The stepmother figure in the film is very ill. Miyazaki's mother was bedbound for years with TB. And I really felt that some of the more inscrutable imagery in the film, the beauty of it, was a mark of the kind of late masterpieces you see in composers, like Beethoven's late string quartets. They kind of operate according to Beethoven's own logic. It's like he writes the rules. And I sort of wonder with the film, some people were very confused by it, and commentators came out saying, oh, you know, the imagery is very beautiful, but I don't know how it hung together. And I just wonder whether it's because he's turning inwards. It's that thing that great artists do towards the end. They sort of retreat into themselves and want to work out things for themselves. But could you, that's kind of jumping ahead a bit, could you sort of run through, like, give your first impressions and also run through the kind of plot and what is different and what is similar to the work that Miyazaki has done before?
Yeah, sure. And I hope we have a chance to come back to how you were affected by it. That sounds extraordinary. So I'm quite fresh from seeing it yesterday evening with my son. We saw the dubbed version. I couldn't find a version somewhere which had the original Japanese audio. And I'm not sure whether that affected my viewing of it or not. As a Japanese speaker, I would normally try and find the Japanese original, not as some kind of, you know, film purist move, but just because I find when they dub it in English, the choice of accents tends to confuse me in terms of what they're trying to say about the characters rather than help me along. And I'll confess, I think I went into the cinema, and I'll come to the story in a tick, but I think I went into the cinema not realizing the level of effort and attention that I would have to pay in watching that film. I think you really need to be on your game, focusing on what's going on, trying to understand what's being done with the imagery. As you suggest, there is so much going on. I know I'll be going back as soon as I possibly can to try and work it out. But let's get into the basics then, and we're issuing a bit of a spoiler alert, I suppose, aren't we, just in case. But so we're in 1943, and the war is coming to its climax for Japan. And so right at the beginning, we have this young boy, Mahito, who gets caught up with his father in what I think is supposed to be a fire set off by firebombing. But it certainly is raging fire, in which his mother, Hisako, dies. And so the boy and his father then move out to the countryside, which for Miyazaki fans is quite a popular start to a plot for a Miyazaki film, you know, moving away from the city into the countryside where mysterious, magical, quite strange things may happen. They move out, and his father, rather abruptly, as my son pointed out, has moved on from his dead wife and has married the sister of Mahito's mother. So her name is Natsuko. And this is where it all gets going. The young Mahito, really powerful scenes of a grieving and confused young boy who, on top of his grief, is now being forced to cope with a brand new lifestyle out in the countryside amongst these other boys at the school that he joins who clearly dislike him rather powerfully. As you mentioned, his father is this airplane making tycoon, and so he's got a particular position in that school, whereas the boys have seen all their family members being conscripted and I think are pretty resentful of Mahito when he joins the class. I found the first 40 minutes.
There's a very funny bit actually where the father says, "It's going to look great if you rock up in a car. You're just going to look so brilliant." I could just imagine, you know, me as a schoolboy going, "Oh, Dad, don't do that. It's going to, you know,
Exactly.
they're going to bully me."
He's funny, isn't it? Because oddly, Mahito seems to be, I think it must be the grief, but he's kind of resigned to that, isn't it? He doesn't put up much of a spirited defense. As you say, any other child would have said, "You're joking, aren't you? I'm all going to walk the final 5 minutes or so." But he's lost in his own little world, I suppose, isn't he? I don't know about you. I found that first 40 minutes or so, getting used to that new home, that story of trying to get used to his friends in the school, the lovely gaggle of old women who are helping to run this quite wealthy household. I thought they were beautifully drawn, the way they walk, the way they fuss over him. I think at that point, Miyazaki entirely had me. I was really enjoying it and I knew what was going on. It's only after that it gets a little bit strange, I think. Maybe you want to take up the story at that point because possibly you've understood more of it than I have.
Well, and I totally agree. His films, there are often wonderfully drawn older female characters, as well as a fantastic range of female characters. I remember how unforgettable, for example, Chihiro, the kind of main protagonist of Spirited Away, was. You know, he was like impulsive, brave, really complex. And I love that about the films. I think it's something people always come away from any of his films, that the female characters often shine more brightly, they're almost fuller, more fully realized in a funny way than the male characters. And the men can often be quite dull, stupid, just especially adult men in Miyazaki films can be a bit brutal and kind of one note. But I think that's a quality of the film. So just to pick up the story, yeah, he's in this. Everything is really odd. You know, you've got the replacement mother figure, and he's in this a place that is both familiar and unfamiliar. You know, his dad is still there. He's going to school. At the school has this moment of, I don't know what it is, he almost impulsive moment where he grinds a rock into the side of his head. And again, I often think about, as you say, they don't talk down to children, these films. I think Miyazaki, who's very, very well read in European literature, especially things like Jules Verne, I think Verne is a great comparison to Miyazaki as someone who is able to cross that boundary between the kind of literature that children really relates to, and also things that lead straight into adulthood as well. Maybe Robert Louis Stevenson, another example in English, someone who wrote books which for children and adults and for both, and could sort of handle that mixture of themes. And yeah, it's quite disturbing, that bit. So he's now bedbound, the child. There is this strange relationship. There's a heron, and this is obviously reflected in the title of the film, who's sort of circling the house. Herons, popularly quite cruel birds. I don't know if I've ne never seen a heron that looks particularly nice or well-meaning, but the heron, it definitely has something more to him than just a normal heron. You know, and a lot of his films are full of animism, so human beings that turn into animals and animals that turn into monsters. So you think, okay, there's going to be something more to this heron. So he has this encounter with the heron, who leads him on this kind of wild goose chase into this ruin, castle ruin, and there's a suggestion that his new mother figure, this stepmother who's been ill, has and is pregnant actually, has gone into these ruins, and he needs to go and rescue her. And then within this sort of castle, he enters through a kind of doorway into another dream world, and I think that's what you're talking about, is where it might have lost you a bit. It has the quality of a dream. Time is really mixed up. It really reminded me of, it's very, very dreamlike. And I think it's full of very powerful symbols of the unconscious. A lot of open doors, a lot of closed doors, a lot of doors which lead nowhere. And he basically goes on a series of trials with the help of, again, a wonderful female character called Lady Himi, who's kind of his age, but is also really powerful, is like preternaturally wise, considerate, brave, and has this hidden power. They go through a series of trials, and eventually he's trying to rescue this mother figure. And again, I don't really want to spoil it, but the climax of the film is acts of symbolic recovery of the mother and a kind of realization about who Lady Hemi is, this companion, who she really is. And together they kind of represent a very powerful symbol of recovering, like, difficult emotional material for him, recovering the spirit of his mother who's died in the fire, recovering a sense of lost innocence. And the film finishes with a very beautiful image of the everyday and him being back in the everyday world with his father and his new mother. And it's just like a boy going to school sort of scene. It's just like what you imagine childhood to be like or should be like, you know, just ordinary and not weird. What is confusing about it is that he is working with these dreamlike symbols. There's one of these symbols where they're in this almost subterranean world, which has a sky which is in gold and orange and many, many colours, a world of the sea where it just goes to the horizon. That is somewhere I have actually been in a dream. You know, it's one of a recurring dream that I've had. Miyazaki is very conscious in all of his films that you can't... He's always talking about how the world is cursed and how the world has lost its meaning and power. And his characters are often saying, you know, that it's like we're labouring under some spell that's been cast by a malign influence. And I think so many of his films are about that, with Spirited Away, Princess Mononoke, yeah, and so on. Especially his most kind of epic, profound films. You know, the world is cursed. So how do you live in a world that is just so irrational and cursed and difficult? And I think Miyazaki is very committed to that idea that you can't do it by rationalizing the world and by explaining it. You have to find some symbols that make sense, and you have to replace the symbols that have died, the symbols that have lost their potency, with new and better symbols. That's why I think names are really important in Miyazaki's films. A name can be really powerful. A word can unlock a world. So I really, really love this film, and it kind of I really want to see it again and again because, you know, because I found it really, really powerful. But I do understand why people find it confusing.
For me, it really opens it up when you talk about the symbolic element of it and the Jungian element of it. And it's a very Jungian idea, isn't it? The idea that our symbols can become worn out and that we need to renew them, otherwise they don't do the job that they do. And you used a turn of phrase there that takes us, I think, to the Japanese title for this film, which is Kimitachi wa dou ikiruka, which is how do you live, or how do you lot live in the plural. I always wonder whether having casting the blame elsewhere for the fact that I struggled to understand what was going on, but that title in Japanese perhaps preps us a little bit more for what Miyazaki is about to ask of us. Perhaps in any case, I certainly think if you go with that symbolic reading and the Jungian reading, then it does make sense that you would need to probably see it two or three times in the way that, you know, in any kind of therapeutic context, to circle around things a little bit rather than expect there to be a single clear one-shot message that you can take away. It's interesting to read some of the reviews of the film because people do fall back on quite abstract turns of phrase, that it's all about coping with grief, that it's about redemption, that it's about fragility. All these things are true, but at the same time, it's tough to give a really clear sense, I think, of what's going on in it. For me particularly, a figure we've not yet mentioned, who I found fascinating but again rather enigmatic, was the grand uncle figure. So he's someone way back in the history of this family who we think is responsible for building the tower that you've mentioned. And I think he was last seen in that tower. So there's a sense that in some way his spirit is still there. And we find him in there really concerned with how the world is on the brink of disintegrating, sort of represented in front of him by what looked like almost a child's building block playset. You know, you've got those rectangular shapes, you've got the spheres, you've got the pyramids, and he's building them up in this very fragile-looking Jenga tower, which could topple at any moment. And is there at one point he turns to Mahito, or he turns to someone else he's talking to, and he says, well, you know, this one's about to fall, how would you build it?
Yeah.
And I think that's really Miyazaki's concern, isn't it? The world is on the verge of some kind of cataclysm, and he's asking the next generation, well, how would you reset things to make it a little bit more stable?
After 40 minutes, when he goes into this world, I do think you are in the boy's own imagination, and his own dream world. And that's you know, what it's trying to explore. I think for Miyazaki, it's that late masterpiece thing. It feels like he's playing with things that he hasn't been able to resolve, maybe things that still dog him after all these years, and he's returning. I find it interesting that it's very much set in Japan, and a lot of his films are not set in Japan at all, even in South Wales, Italy, but it had such a Japanese setting. And it, you know, whereas a lot of his films, I feel they feel kind of very blended with European culture. I didn't think that was true at all here.
No, that's right. And it's interesting, you've mentioned several of his other films. I suspect that people who are familiar with his work already and their themes will probably get the most out of this new one. But the film that it made me think of, one of his earliest ones back in the 1980s, Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind, with that real concern for what rural Japan might still be able to provide for people in terms of not just a connection with nature, but it's this sense in Miyazaki's films. I think it links in part to Shinto in Japan, but it's a very similar theme that you'll find in other cultures as well, that nature is not just nature, but it's a conduit for really the life of the world in this very fundamental way. And so Nausicaa is this heroine who's trying to protect that world from the encroachment of smoky, industrial, extractive chaos. The Nausicaa film, I think, is probably easier to get one's head around because the overall plot of the film, the goodies, the baddies, as it were, to really simplify it, is fairly straightforward. But once you understand these concerns of Miyazaki through films like Nausicaa, I think it's easier to come to The Boy and the Heron and understand what's going on. I suppose another thought comes to me as you were speaking there is, and I think this is again something from Japan's modern history, one thing that animators like Miyazaki I think have always been suspicious of is the easy answer to humanity's problems, you know, a kind of clear ideological line that if we can persuade people of this, get on board, run the country in this way, then everything will be better. You know, he's grown up in the aftermath of a disastrous attempt to do exactly that in Japan. And I think instead he's trying to warn people off these very simple and straightforward answers. And I suppose thinking about it, Mahito's father really is a very straightforward man to the point of being slightly embarrassing. You know, you mentioned that moment of self-harm, this very graphic, disturbing moment of self-harm from Mahito. And the first thing his father wants to know when he's done that is who's responsible for it? We'll find them. I'm going to call the school. We'll sort all this out. And he is the man of very, very simple, straightforward answers. And instead, Mahito, by having almost what it seems at the beginning to be a kind of lack of real personality or character, he has that transparency, doesn't he, to what else might be going on in the world that, for whatever reason, his father really lacks.
It's a very powerful theme that he develops about the relationship with his mother. It's like he's doubly cursed. You know, he couldn't save his mother. There's in the first 5 minutes, and it's pretty odd for a children's film, really, you know, something that can be pitched to children. The first 5 minutes, you're confronted with a boy trying to rush to the hospital where his mum works to try and save her from the fire. Any child will tell you that the thing that they find hardest is seeing their mother in pain and them feeling helpless to help them. That's pushing that idea to its very limit. So, and then, you know, his new mother, who's also his mother's sister and looks exactly like her, this kind of double for his mother, who is his father, you know, is now in a relationship with. When she wanders off, she sort of is weak and ill, and he can't help her either. And when she wanders into the castle and into the forest, it's like, I'm going to do it for real this time. I'm going to save her. And I think that territory is why you get such rich symbolism later on. But it's not a theme that Miyazaki has not explored before. You know, and Spirited Away begins with Chihiro's parents being transformed into pigs because they overeat in a kind of market. And then she's thrown into this kind of spirit world bathhouse where everyone is kind of lying. No one tells the truth. It's all very weird and confusing, but again, this abandonment of parents and being alone in the world without your parents, and then trying to compensate for that that seems to me to run through all the films. And I know Miyazaki himself disdains this idea that his films are about trauma. He sort of is much more hard edged about it. He said, you know, it's, as you say, it's with the title, it's about how to live. Everyone's lives are difficult. Everyone goes through difficult emotional periods, but it's about how you then transform that material and how you work with the raw material of life.
Just to agree with you, I think requiring children at some point to, as it were, step up and contribute something when the adult world is falling apart, or one of the parents, or in the case of Spirited Away, both of the parents suddenly out of action, turning into pigs, that children can be abruptly asked to take on quite a lot of responsibility all of a sudden. I think that is a theme that comes back now and again in Miyazaki. For me, one of the powerful moments with Mahito's mother in the film that we're talking about here, and it's hard at some points in that dreamy long second half to know precisely who is who, but there's one moment when it's either his mother or his stepmother lying in the bed, still unwell, and he manages to find her, but she shrieks at him either to go away or that he's not wanted. I mean, what did you make of that?
Well, this is a classic kind of dream image, and I've had this in my own dreams, is people you know very, very well suddenly turning to you with an expression which you've never seen on their face before, either of hatred or blankness or dispassion. You address someone and they just look at you like they're looking through you, or they snarl at you. They've got a distorted face. That person has so much power over you in the dream. We've kind of talked a lot about Miyazaki. And I guess to conclude, I'd like to ask, like, what do you think is coming next for Studio Ghibli? There's a kind of sense, isn't there, that of with Miyazaki, it's sort of après moi, c'est le déluge. You know, he has no successor. And his succession plans have all ended in sort of tragic circumstances. His relationship with his own son is famously not very straightforward. I think his son was directed their production of Tales from Earthsea, originally written by Ursula Le Guin, which was not a success. And at the premiere, Miyazaki went out for a cigarette. He's an inveterate chain smoker, I think. But apparently his son Goro once said that Miyazaki got zero marks for being a dad, but top marks for being an animator. Just like, oh dear, not what you want to hear from your son. But yeah, just to come back to, he doesn't seem to, and the other succession plans, his great partner and sort of sparring partner, Takahata Izawa, has died. Yes. And his protege died at quite a young age. Yeah, it's not worked out. So, what do you think? This is such a huge, you know, cultural artifact for Japan. It's so famous. It's so world-renowned. What happens next? Yes.
Gosh, I think the moment out of which Miyazaki and Ghibli came, the historical moment that we talked about towards the beginning, has passed in any case. So I to be honest, I'm not sure it's an enormous loss for Japan if Studio Ghibli ends up taking a slightly more modest place in the country's animation output. I mean, there are people out there. One of the names that springs to mind would be Makoto Shinkai, this animator who sometimes gets talked about as being potentially the next Miyazaki. He's come out with a range of really well-received pieces recently, things like Your Name, Weathering With You, Suzume, which I think are all connected, those three, available, I think, on Netflix, at least one or two of them. And Miyazaki, he says, is a great influence on him. And he's born in the early 70s, so he's almost addressing a new cultural moment in Japan. Mm. And I suppose at the same time, since one of the big achievements, of course, of Miyazaki and Studio Ghibli has been to bring Japanese animation to these massive global audiences. But now if you look out there, the sorts of things that young people are watching, the success of a manga like One Piece, which I think is second only to the Harry Potter franchise in terms of worldwide sales, I think Miyazaki's sort of done the job. You know, back in Japan, he's helped generations of people to process what went on in the war, to speak to this new generation of children, as we've talked about. And now that Japan has moved on, I think there are so many animators out there, so many studios out there that are flourishing in Japan and around the world. I don't want to say that people will be all right without Miyazaki. It sounds awfully callous, but I think he's helped to inspire and to grow Japanese animation to the point where it doesn't need Studio Ghibli to succeed in order to carry on.
And Japan itself, I guess, is changing. I mean, Miyazaki himself is an inveterate pacifist, but Japan is now moving away from its pacifist position.
That's a very good point. Yeah, I think there's, I mean, Miyazaki was a Marxist early on, and as you say, also a pacifist. He's of a generation which is dying out. I think now with China sort of year on year becoming more of a worry for people. Also, perhaps more negatively in Japan, a sense of the younger generation not really having a very strong concept of that Second World War era, and certainly most of them not really having any sense that they ought to atone for it or learn from it. You know, whether that's necessarily a good thing or not, who knows? But certainly people are moving on, and I think what we really need are animators who can talk to this current moment in Japan, which is awfully uncertain for all sorts of reasons. I suppose another one would be Japan's very difficult looking demographic future. It seems to be every 5 minutes you find a news article, don't you, about how difficult things are. Japanese couples thinking they don't have the money to have children. Still, this is a country which is very unsure about whether it wants immigration on any significant scale. So all these sorts of challenges, you know, we really do need a new generation of animators to come through and deal with that. I suppose my only concern now and again, especially through my son, I get involved in a lot of Japanese manga and animation, is the fantasy element is extraordinarily strong. But I sometimes wonder, the bits and pieces that I see, whether it's fantasy alongside a certain amount of escapism. How many animators out there who can capture big audiences like Miyazaki can also get across a really powerful message that can cause people to reflect? That's something that I personally am on the lookout for now. Who is it that can really speak to the current cultural moment in Japan, as opposed to providing people with just a certain level of entertainment? I'd be really interested if anyone has suggestions on who we ought to be looking out for there, because we do need people who are politically engaged, Japanese animators who are really engaged in where the country is now, and who perhaps want to encourage young Japanese to engage in their own politics. You now and again, I think in Japan, get a sense of people being so disappointed by their politicians to the point of thinking, well, I'll just live my life independently of politics as far as possible. Let them get on with it and make the best life that I possibly can. And, you know, that can't possibly be helpful. So some of these more politically engaged animators, if we start to see them coming through, I think that'll be tremendously exciting.
Thanks, Chris. That's a great note to end on, a call to action for listeners and a kind of call to reflect on Miyazaki's wonderful achievements. Do go and see the film. It is wonderful. And thanks, Chris, for a fascinating conversation.
This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation.